A just cause is a cause so just, we would be willing to sacrifice our interests in order to advance it.
Welcome, this is Think Tank. Today, a special from the seminar Purpose-Driven Leadership with our guest of honor, Simon Sinek. Hans, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why Sinek in this event?
Yeah, so I've been organizing events for years and years, and Simon Sinek is one of the most creative and innovative thinkers I know. He's a very capable of transforming ideas that people have a good gut feeling about into practical advice and things you can do, start doing tomorrow. It really gives hands-on advice and things to start doing for your business and to make it a better business.
Mm-hmm. For people who don't know purpose-driven leadership, can you tell a little bit about the seminar? What is it about?
Purpose-driven leadership is about making an organization that puts meaning over metrics. So how do you make an organization that's actually driven by purpose and still be successful as a business? So it's not charity, but it's business with a good heart.
Okay, and Simon is the expert on why, meaning, purpose.
Yes, so, yeah. Yes. It all started, of course, with his book, Why, but his new book, The Infinite Game, also has the same gut feeling. So you do business with good intentions and to make the world a better place, and you're also successful as an entrepreneur with that.
Okay. You will hear the complete talk of Simon Sinek on stage during Purpose-Driven Leadership, but first we speak with him in the dressing rooms in Theater Amsterdam. Simon Sinek, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is a Think Tank, our podcast. And it has been 10 years since Start With Why. So that's a long, like, it's a decennium. Now your new book, The Infinite Game. And there are five essential practices in the book. I will name them. Just cause, trusting teams, worthy rivals, existential flexibility. Wow. That's a word. And courage to lead. And I'm wondering, with worthy rivals, we want to beat competitors, but there's not such a thing as winning in the infinite game. Can you tell a little bit about this concept of worthy rivals?
Sure. So a finite game has a beginning, middle, and end. There's known players, fixed rules, and an agreed upon objective, like football, right? Mm-hmm. There's a winner and a loser at the end of the game.
Sure.
An infinite game, you know some of the players, you don't know all the players, and new players can join the game at any time. You can play however you want. There's no fixed rules. And the objective is to perpetuate the game, to stay in the game as long as possible. So business, for example, is an infinite game. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know all your competitors, and new companies can start up at any time. You can change the way you play. You can play differently tomorrow, and you play completely differently than all the other companies in your industry. And so to try to win in a game of business is impossible because there's no finish line. There's no agreed upon metrics.
No.
And so the problem is we view the other players in the game as competitors. But a competitor is someone you try to beat. Mm-hmm. And when you set out to try and beat another player in a game that cannot be won, in a game that there's no agreed upon anything, what ends up happening is you hurt trust, cooperation, and innovation in your own company quite by accident. Mm-hmm. And so I propose, instead of viewing the other players as competitors, you view them as rivals. Mm-hmm. And some of those rivals are worthy of comparison, because a worthy rival does something better than you. Maybe their marketing is better than yours. Maybe their product is better than yours. Instead of trying to beat them, rather be grateful that they exist, because a worthy rival's strengths reveal to us our own weaknesses, which means we can improve. Because if the goal is to stay in the game as long as possible and perpetuate the game, it's really a game of constant improvement.
Mm-hmm. Is it also something like Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader? I mean, the rival, the worthy rival part. I mean, is it like the villain, or not a villain in the hero's
journey? No, because that's it's not a that's still an adversarial. You're setting up an adversarial relationship.
Okay, yeah, sure.
It's not an adversarial relationship. No. It's simply the acknowledgement that there are other players who do what I do.
Yeah,
and some of them do it better than me, or some of them do a parts of it better than me. What can I learn from them so that I can be better?
Yeah.
And whether they go out of business or stay in business, or whether their business goes up or down is up to them. Mm. But I'm going to be focused on how I'm doing rather than how I'm doing relative to them.
Nice.
And if you look at a company and that people that work in companies that are really competitive and want to beat the customer, their competition, they may even beat their customers because of that. But how, if you work there and you want to start a movement towards more looking at competition as a worthy rival, or for instance, build trusting teams, or go for a just cause, what are things that people can do to start that movement?
Well, all of this stuff that we're talking about is about mindset. It's how we choose to view other people or choose to view other companies.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have worthy rivals inside your company on your own team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's bad to have competitors on your own team, because if you view each other as competitors, then you withhold information.
Mm-hmm.
You may sabotage somebody else's deal.
Mm-hmm.
You don't like to share.
Mm-hmm.
You don't like to help, because what if they get the advantage? That's what happens if we create competitive relationships inside our own organizations.
Yeah.
But we should have rivals. We've all had the experience where somebody in our company got promoted and we got angry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they don't deserve it. I deserve it. You know? Well, what is it about them that made you angry? That they were successful?
Yeah.
What weakness does it reveal in us? And so we can absolutely have worthy rivals even on our own team.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who's a better speaker, someone who's a better strategic thinker, someone who's a better tactical thinker, someone who's a better executor, somebody who's more organized.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that they do better than us? And instead of being angry because what it does is it reveals our insecurities, reveals our weaknesses, and rather either learn from them or partner with them.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who's a brilliant strategic thinker should partner with a brilliant tactical thinker, because they're never going to get as good at the other person's discipline, but together they're an unstoppable force.
Yeah. And even if the company's ratios and metrics are really competitive based, you can still start a movement in your own team.
I mean, clearly, the incentives in a company are going to influence our behavior a great deal, of course. But still, we can take steps to move in the right direction, to play with an infinite mindset, of course.
Okay, thanks.
Simon, there's also a connection between the infinite mindset of younger people and maybe the finite mindset of older people in the workplace.
Age plays no
role.
Yeah. Plays no role. It's, you know, if anything, you know, the ones that we may view as older with a finite mindset have just been playing in a finite way for too long. That they're bad. It's old habits, you know.
Mm.
So if they came up through the ranks in the 80s and 90s, which was like the heyday of finite thinking, then that's how they learned to do business. So they're not bad people. They just have bad habits.
Mm.
You know. And so young people who may be more idealistic may appear to have more an infinite mindset, but it's not a condition of age at all. It's a condition of choice, of one's own mindset, one's own ambitions, and the way one was raised, or you know, the kind of training we've had.
And if I have those habits, those old habits, maybe how can I move myself towards an infinite mindset?
Well, if I have old habits of sitting on the couch and never exercising and only eating fatty foods, how do I move myself to exercise and eat healthy?
Uh-huh.
Well, you got to do it.
Mm.
You know, you start small. You don't have to change your entire life. Start by eating one healthy meal a week. You know, start by going to the gym once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Start by doing one push-up every night. You know, and you develop good habits. You start to enjoy things, and then do two, then do three. It's the same thing here. You know, you start small. Start somewhere. I offer these five practices. You can't do them all at once. It's too hard.
No.
And you don't have to do them in any particular order.
Okay.
Just do them. It's like, which should I do first? Should I eat better, or should I go to the gym first? I don't know. Just do one of them. Eventually, you have to do all of them.
What practice do you like most of those five?
I don't like any of them most. I mean,
they're hard.
They all have value. They all have value at different times. They all require different kinds of attention, and they all require constant attention.
Yeah.
What are you going to teach the audience today about your new book, and also about leadership in general?
Well, I'm going to talk about the infinite game. Mm-hmm. I find it so fascinating, and it's completely changed the way I approach leadership, and it's the next logical step after all my other work. And mm-hmm. so it's I love sharing the idea, to be honest.
Mm. Yeah. Was there a specific moment where you got the idea for the Infinite Game? Because you're very good at, you know, making ideas tangible and put them into a format that everybody understands.
Right. So the idea, the concept of the finite and infinite game is from James Carse. Yeah. He's a philosopher. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered Carse's work, it profoundly changed my view of the world. As brilliant as Carse's work is, it's philosophy. It's not actionable. Yeah. And so, as much as I was drawn to this work, I didn't know what to do with it. Mm. And I wanted to make it useful for me, for others. And so what I wrote about is building on the foundation of Carse's philosophy, mm-hmm. his perspective on the world, but how to actually make it useful.
Yeah. All right, Simon, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you very much.
For being on the Think Tank. I wish you good luck on the stage today.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And hopefully till next time.
Until next time.
Simon Sinek in the dressing room in Theater Amsterdam during the seminar Purpose Driven Leadership. And this is Simon on stage during his talk.
January 1968. The North Vietnamese Army launches a surprise attack against American forces in Vietnam. This is the Tet Offensive. There is always a tradition in Vietnam that there was never any fighting on Tet. Tet is the Lunar New Year. And this had been around for decades. But in 1968, the leaders of the North Vietnamese Army decided to break with tradition with the hope that they would overwhelm American forces and bring a swift end to the Vietnam War. They threw 85,000 troops at over 125 targets that day. Here's the amazing thing. The United States and its allies repelled every single attack, every single one. At the end of most of the major fighting, which had ceased after about a week, the Americans had lost fewer than 1,000 troops. The North Vietnamese lost 35,000 of the 85,000 troops they attacked with. In fact, if we look at the Vietnam War as a whole, the United States lost 58,000 men. The North Vietnamese lost 3 million people. And America actually won most of the major battles that it fought in that war, which raises a very interesting question. How do you win all the battles, decimate your enemy, and lose the war? As it turns out, we don't really have a clear understanding of what winning and losing always means. There are other definitions. In 1986, a philosopher by the name of James Carse articulated that if you have at least one competitor, you have a game. And there are two types of games, finite games and infinite games. A finite game is defined as known players, fixed rules, and an agreed upon objective, football. There's always a beginning, middle, and an end. And if there's a winner, there's going to be a loser. An infinite game is defined as known and unknown players. The rules are changeable, which means you can play however you want. And the objective is to perpetuate the game, to stay in the game as long as possible. When you pit a finite player with a finite player, the system is stable. Football is stable. When you pit an infinite player with an infinite player, the system is also stable. The Cold War was stable because we could not have a winner or a loser. And both kept playing just to keep the game in play. In an infinite game, because there is no winner or loser, one of the players drops out of the game when they run out of the will or the resources to continue to play, but the game continues with them or without them. Problems arise, however, in an infinite game when you pit a finite player with an infinite player. Because finite players are playing to win, and an infinite player is playing to keep playing, and both will make strategic choices accordingly. And this is what happened to the United States in Vietnam. The United States was fighting to win, and the North Vietnamese were fighting for their lives. And what always happens to a finite player playing in the infinite game is you get caught in quagmire. You run through the will and the resources that are required to keep playing. I had a real life experience that helped me really recognize what this looks like in the business world. I spoke at an education summit for Apple. And I also spoke at an education summit for Microsoft. At the Microsoft summit, the vast majority of the executives, spent most of their presentations talking about how to beat Apple. At the Apple summit, 100% of the executives spent 100% of their presentations talking about how to help teachers teach and how to help students learn. One was obsessed with where they were going, the other one was obsessed with beating their competition. Guess which one was in quagmire? Guess which one was racing through the will and resources needed to stay in the game? At the end of my talk at Microsoft, they gave me a gift. They gave me the new Zune when it was a thing. Zune was Microsoft's response to the iPod. And this little piece of technology they gave me was absolutely fantastic. It was beautifully designed, the user interface was intuitive, it was simple to use. It was really a fantastic little piece of technology. So at the end of my Apple talk, I was sharing a taxi with a very senior Apple executive, employee number 54 to be exact, and I couldn't help myself. I had to stir the pot. So I turned to him and I said, you know, Microsoft gave me their new Zune. It is so much better than your iPod Touch. And he looked at me and he said, I have no doubt. And the conversation was over. Because he understood that sometimes you have the better product and sometimes they have the better product. The goal is not to win. The goal is not to beat your competitor. The goal is to outlast your competitor. And the more I started to understand this concept of the infinite game, the more I started to recognize that we are players in infinite games every day of our lives. There's no such thing as being number one in your marriage. Good luck with that. There's no such thing as winning global politics. And there's definitely no such thing as winning business. No one is declared the winner of business because there's no finish line. But if we listen to the language of so many leaders, they talk about being number one, being the best, and beating their competition. Based on what? Based on what agreed upon metrics, based upon what agreed upon timeframes. Which means we have so many companies that are being led by people who are playing with a finite mindset, playing to win, in a game that is an infinite game. There is no finish line. And when we play with a finite mindset in the infinite game, there's a few very predictable and consistent outcomes. The decline of trust, the decline of cooperation, and the decline of innovation. Which means we actually have to learn to play for the game we're actually in. So if we have to play with an infinite mindset for this infinite game of business that we're actually in, the question is, how do we do it? There are five practices that we have to do, that we have to practice. Five things we have to practice. Number one, we have to advance a just cause. Number two, we have to build trusting teams. Number three, we have to study our worthy rivals. Number four, we have to maintain a capacity for existential flexibility. And number five, we have to have the courage to lead. Okay, just cause. A just cause is a cause so just, we would be willing to sacrifice our interests in order to advance it. Now, one of my favorite examples was written in the Declaration of Independence, which identifies the founding of the United States. And in this document, they envisioned a nation in which all men are created equal, endowed with certain unalienable rights, amongst which include life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In other words, what they were doing is envisioning an idealized state of the future that, for all intents and purposes, is actually unachievable. But they will die trying, and that's the point. It's about advancing towards it. Winning the Revolutionary War was just one of the finite victories required to get upon their journey. But then the hard work begins. And for over 240 years, America has been trying to get closer and closer and closer to this ideal. And that's what a just cause is. It's a vision of the future so compelling, so just, that we would be willing to sacrifice in order to advance it. Now, in the business world, having a just cause, we can call it a vision if you like. The reason I like the word just cause better is because the word vision has no standard definition. We call it vision because you have to be able to see it, something distant in the future so clear that the rest of us can imagine it as well. Unfortunately, it's become used synonymously with long-term goals. Our vision is to improve top-line revenues by €1 billion by 2025. That's not a vision, it's just a big goal. towards what? Why do you need to achieve those top line revenues? To what end? What are you trying to advance? That's what the just cause is. And sacrifice doesn't always have to mean your life. It could mean working late hours, turning down a better paying job offer because you want to continue to work here, frequent business trips where you miss your family. You may not like these things, but they feel worth it. And that's the point of having a just cause. It gives people something to belong to. And this is why innovation happens. We can't tell people be more innovative, but we can tell them to figure out ways to move the organization closer to this ideal. And all the greatest organizations, the ones that we admire, the truly innovative organizations, compel their people to try and figure out ways to get closer and closer to a broader ideal. When Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak founded Apple, they had a vision, they had a just cause, to empower individuals to stand up to Big Brother, to give individuals the power one day to compete with a corporation, which is why they were so enamored by the personal computer, because it gave individuals power that they didn't previously have. Do you know that Steve Jobs came up with none of the products that Apple sells? None of them. He told his people to advance that cause, and they found the ways in order to empower individuals or challenge the status quo. The iPhone is not special because of the flat screen. What's special about the iPhone is that it completely changed the business model, giving the power back to us, back to the consumer. The way that that industry used to work is that the mobile phone provider, T-Mobile, would tell the cell phone manufacturer, Samsung, LG, what the phone is going to do. That's how it used to work. Apple showed up and said, we're going to tell you what the phone's going to do and you're going to provide it. Because Apple put the consumer at the front of the development of the phone. And the reason AT&T had an opportunity to have an exclusive contract was because they were the only ones that said yes. Apple offered their product and their business model to everyone who wanted it. Again, empowering the individual so that we get to have what we want, not get told what we want. This was what profound innovation looks like when we give people a just cause. If you want to play in the infinite game of business, you must give your people a just cause. Number two, trusting teams. I went on a business trip to Las Vegas, and I stayed at the Four Seasons. They put me up at the Four Seasons out there, which is a beautiful hotel. And the reason it's a wonderful hotel is not because of the fancy beds. Any hotel can buy a fancy bed. It's because of the people who work there. That when you walk the halls of the Four Seasons and someone says hello to you, you get the distinct feeling that they wanted to say hello, not that they were told to say hello. We're highly attuned social animals. We can tell the difference. They happen to have a coffee bar in the lobby of the Four Seasons in Las Vegas, and one afternoon I went and bought myself a cup of coffee, and there happened to be a barista working that day named Noah. Noah was funny and charming and engaging, and I stood there for far too long talking to Noah because I enjoyed talking to him so much. And as is my nature, I asked Noah, do you like your job? And without skipping a beat, Noah said, I love my job. Now in my line of business, that's significant. Like is rational. I like the people I work with, I like what the work that I do, I get paid well, I like my job. Love is emotional, it's a higher order connection, right? Do you love your wife? I like her a lot, right? Not the same. Noah said, I love my job. So immediately my ears perked up. Immediately I followed up and I said, Noah, tell me specifically what it is that the Four Seasons is doing that you would say to me you love your job. Without skipping a beat, Noah said that throughout the day, managers will walk past him and ask him how he's doing, ask him if there's anything that he needs to do his job better, not just his manager, any manager. And then he said, I also work at another hotel, and there the managers walk past us and catch us when we're doing things wrong. There, they want us to make the numbers and perform, and I just keep my head below the radar, and I want to just get through the day and collect my paycheck. He said, only at the Four Seasons do I feel I can be myself. Now remember, this is the exact same human being in two different leadership environments, and my experience of him will be profoundly different, not because of him, but because of the place that he works, because the people who lead him. I get this question all the time. Simon, how do we get the most out of our people? People are not a towel. We can't wring them out. We can't get the most out of them. It's a flawed question. The correct question is, how do we create an environment in which our people can work at their natural best? And the answers will be profoundly different. So often we think the failure of performance is because of the person, and we rarely ever think to consider the environment in which our people are working. And this is the point of leadership. Leadership is the profound responsibility to see that those around us rise. Leadership is not about being in charge, it's about taking care of those in our charge. And this is a fascinating misconception. Because if we are to play in the infinite game, we have to create an environment in which people feel like they can trust each other, be on trusting teams, and it is a leader's responsibility to build those trusting teams. We all know what it feels like to be on a trusting team. We've all been there. It's when we can raise our hand and say to our colleagues or our boss, I made a mistake. Or, I'm having trouble at home, it's affecting my work. Or, I don't feel like I can do the job you've asked me to do, I need more training. Or I'm scared. Or I need help. Without any fear of humiliation or retribution. In fact, we say these things with absolute confidence that someone will rush in to support us. In other words, we're comfortable being vulnerable. This is what it means to be psychologically safe. It means we're willing to share with people our weaknesses. I made a mistake. I don't know what I'm doing. I need help. Because if we don't work on a trusting team, what we're asking our people to do is come to work every single day and lie and hide and fake. To hide mistakes for fear that it'll make them vulnerable the next round of layoffs. To never admit that they don't know what they're doing for fear that it'll get them fired. Never admit undue stress that one is suffering. And definitely don't ask for help. Instead, people pretend that they know how to do everything when they don't, and think and say that everything's going perfectly when it isn't. And in that kind of model, it can work for a while, but eventually the cracks start to build, and eventually something's going to break. We know what this looks like in the extreme. We've all seen the video from United Airlines where they dragged a paying customer off the airplane with a broken nose, broken teeth, and a concussion. I feel sorry for every member of that crew, because every single one of them knew that that was bad, that was the wrong thing, but none of them intervened, because they were more afraid of breaking the rules than doing the right thing. They did not feel safe in their own company. I saw evidence of this years before on United. A scene played out in front of me where one of the passengers attempted to board the aircraft before their group number was called, which, as you all know, is a serious crime. And that's exactly how the gate agent talked to him. Sir, I haven't called your number. Please step aside and wait till I call your number, is how she talked to a paying customer. So I spoke up. I said, why do you have to talk to us that way? Why can't you talk to us like we're human beings? And she looked me in the eye and said, sir, if I don't follow the rules, I could get in trouble or lose my job. All she revealed to me is that she does not feel safe in her own organization. She feels that she has no discretion to make decisions, and she is not trusted to do the job for which she's been trained to do. And guess who suffers? Customer, company, and employee. The reason we love flying Virgin, for example, is not because they have some magical formula to hire the best people. It's because the people who work there feel psychologically safe when they come to work. They feel like they have discretion, that they can make decisions. And guess who benefits? Customer, company, and all the people who work there. If you want to play in the infinite game, we have to commit ourselves to building trusting teams. It's essential. Number three, study your worthy rivals. There's another guy who does what I do. He writes books, he gives talks. He's extremely well respected. He's very good at what he does. I respect his work a great deal, and I absolutely hate him. He's never done anything to me. He's always been very cordial whenever I've seen him professionally. I just have an irrational hatred of him. And because of my irrational hatred of him, I'm really competitive with him. So I will regularly go online and I will look at my book sales rankings, and then I will immediately look at his. I don't look at anyone else's, just his. And if I'm ahead, I'm smug. And if he's ahead, I'm angry. So, not too long ago, we were both invited to speak at the same conference, on the same stage. And I don't mean like me in the morning, him in the afternoon. I mean, we were going to be interviewed together at the exact same time. And the interviewer thought it would be fun if we introduced each other. So I went first. I turned to him and I said, you make me really insecure. I said, all of your strengths are all of my weaknesses. And whenever your name comes up, it makes me really uncomfortable. He looked at me and he said, funny, I feel the same about you. The reason I was so competitive with him had nothing to do with him. It had everything to do with me. It's because his strengths reveal to me my weaknesses, and it's very hard to take a hard look at ourselves and admit where we are weak, and it is much easier to take all that uncomfortable energy and direct it as competitive energy against somebody else in our industry. It had nothing to do with him. It was all about me. It turned out to be a profound experience for me, because after that day, I never checked his rankings ever again. It turns out people can buy more than one book. In fact, I recognized that our skills were complementary, and we're much more powerful working together, and we've since become actually very close friends, because we both recognized in each other partnership rather than competition. So in a finite game, we have competitors, and competitors are there to be beaten, to win. But in the infinite game, because there is no such thing as winning, having competitors directs our energy in the wrong place. And rather, we have rivals. Other players in our industry should be viewed as rivals, and some of those rivals are worthy rivals. Some of those rivals are worthy of comparison. And when we can recognize that other players in the game, other companies who sell what we sell, are better than us at certain things. Maybe they have better marketing than we do. Maybe they have better leaders. Maybe they have a better culture. The opportunity is to learn where our weaknesses are, and then work on ourselves. The only true competitor in an infinite game is ourselves. It is a game of constant improvement. But if we're ignorant of all the other players in the game, we'll never know where we can excel. Study your worthy rivals. You get to pick whoever you want and however many you want. So pick wisely. Don't pick a company that is a weak company, because then you'll just feel smug all the time and learn nothing and expose all your weaknesses to the market. We can also have worthy rivals inside our own companies. It is very dangerous to create internal competition where we pit our people against each other. And they view each other as competitors, because when our employees view each other as competitors, they will withhold information from each other. They may sabotage each other so they can get ahead of each other when we create internal competition. But absolutely, worthy rivalry internally is very healthy. We've all had the experience where one of our colleagues got promoted and we got angry. Think about that for a second. We got angry at someone else's good fortune. Why not joy? Odds are likely that they do something or have something that we don't, and it makes us feel bad about ourselves, and it's much easier to direct that uncomfortable feeling in anger rather than to take a hard look at ourselves and say, where can I do better? Remember, the goal is constant improvement as individuals or as organizations, and worthy rivals help hold a mirror up to us. If we're obsessed with winning, it can sometimes lead us down a dangerous path where we become obsessed with tripping the other players. It's like running in a race, obsessed with winning. We may trip the other runner just so that we can win, and we will win the race, but we're still a slow runner. And yet, in this race, there is no finish line, because we have to keep running and running and running and running and running. I'll give you a great example of the danger and value of worthy rivalry. As Starbucks was becoming a thing, it became controversial. People believed that Starbucks was putting small mom-and-pop coffee shops out of business. But the data showed otherwise. The data showed that when Starbucks moved into a neighborhood, mom-and-pop coffee shops actually did better. And the reason was two reasons. One, it brought customers to the area. And two, there was a groundswell to help the mom-and-pops from grassroots, and so people directed their business towards the mom-and-pop. And so I had a perfect experience of what it looked like when somebody doesn't have worthy rivalry, when they're not looking to improve. You see, I'm lactose intolerant. I can't have milk. I need soy milk or some milk alternative. And I wanted to give my business to the small mom and pop, and I would walk in and say, do you have any soy milk? And they would say no. And I'd walk across the street to Starbucks because they had it. In other words, they refused to improve their product. And they were used to having an old beat-up couch. And when Starbucks moved in with beautiful shops, they didn't bother replacing their couch. And so we all went for the better business, and it put them out of business. They put themselves out of business because they refused to compete. We're seeing the same thing with Uber right now. Taxi companies that have had a virtual monopoly are suing or complaining or demanding legislation against Uber. Well, I've got news for them. It's not the app. You can make an app to hail a taxi. It's that the product is substandard, because when you have no rivalry, you have nothing to push you to be better, you get away with having a bad product. I live in New York City. Taxis are terrible. Ubers are great, because it's a clean car with a nice driver. Really simple. I could call a taxi with an app. I choose not to. Not because of the app, because of the quality of the product. Having a worthy rival is there to help us see our weaknesses so that we can provide a better service, a better culture, whatever it is that we need to improve. Study your worthy rivals. Be grateful for them. And when one of them drops out of the game, find another one. Number four, a capacity for existential flexibility. This one's a doozy. So the best example of existential flexibility I can give you happened in 1979, 1980. So in December of 1979, Steve Jobs and some of his senior executives went on a tour of Xerox PARC. Xerox PARC was Xerox's R&D division out in Palo Alto, California. Apple was already a big company. They already had the success of the Apple I and the Apple II. Steve Jobs is already a famous CEO. And while they're at Xerox PARC, Xerox shows them something they invented called the graphic user interface. Now remember Steve Jobs' just cause to empower individuals to stand up to Big Brother. And he sees this graphic user interface that allows a computer user to move a mouse, to move a cursor across a desktop, so we can click on icons to work the computer. And he sees this as a profound technology that could empower way more individuals. In other words, you didn't have to learn a computer language anymore. And as they're leaving Xerox PARC, he says to some of his senior executives, we have to invest in this. We have to invest in this graphic user interface thing. And the voice of reason, one of the executives amongst the team, said, Steve, we can't. We've already invested millions of dollars and countless man hours in a completely different strategic direction. We can't simply walk away from that. We can't simply walk away from that investment. We'll blow up our own company. To which Jobs actually said, better we should blow it up than someone else. That decision led to the Macintosh, a computer platform so profound that it completely changed the way we use computers today. The entire software of Windows is designed to act like a Macintosh. The reason that a computer is on every desk and has become a household appliance was because of his willingness to make a profound strategic shift, to walk away from one investment in order to make another investment to advance the just cause. And that's what existential flexibility is. It's the willingness to make profound strategic shifts in order to advance the just cause. This is different from the daily flexibility we need to do business. I'm talking about big things. And for most leaders, you will never have to have an existential flex, or at most one. But we have to maintain the capacity for it in case we need it, or in case our successors need it. And to have the capacity for existential flexibility, one, you have to have a just cause. Otherwise, how will you know what you're working to advance? Otherwise, it's just chasing shiny objects. And two, you better have trusting teams. Because if you're going to ask your people to make a profound strategic shift, it's going to cause short-term pain. And if we don't have trusting teams and people don't know why we're making the shift, they're going to abandon ship or they're going to hunker down and protect themselves. Rather, if we have that just cause and we have trusting teams, our people will say, this is going to be awful. It's the right thing to do. Let's do it. That's existential flexibility. One of the best examples of a company that failed to do it is Kodak. George Eastman had a just cause. It was to democratize photography. Because in his time in the late 19th century, when he invented film, prior to that, the only way you could take a photograph was you had to hire a professional photographer. Because photography was complicated and dangerous and chemicals and heavy and tons of equipment. And we just couldn't take our own pictures. And George Eastman was obsessed with simplifying and making it so that we could. And he invented this thing called film that allowed you and I to take pictures of our own families and our own holidays. And the company went on with this just cause to invent color film and slide projectors and all these crazy things and 110 film that you could drop into your camera. You remember those? Because you were too afraid of threading the film. All of these improvements to make it more and more accessible. And in 1975, one of the engineers at Kodak who believed in George Eastman's founding just cause, a man by the name of Steve Sasson, invented the digital camera. The problem was the senior executives had abandoned the just cause, and they'd become more finite-minded, way more concerned with short-term financial gains and appeasing Wall Street. And they literally decided to suppress the technology for fear that it would cannibalize film sales. They couldn't imagine putting their company through the short-term hell to become a digital company. So instead, they worked to suppress the technology so they could continue selling film. They knew that they had about 10 years lead time before someone else would figure out this digital thing, once the genie was out of the bottle. And to the year, exactly 10 years later, Fuji and Canon started to show up on the market with their versions of digital cameras. And you know what Kodak did over those 10 years to prepare? Nothing. They did nothing. In fact, they ended up making billions of dollars because all of the Japanese companies were using Kodak patents to make their digital cameras. And so superficially, it looked like Kodak was doing great because money was pouring in. Except then the patents ran out. And 5 years later, the company declared bankruptcy. Because if you're not willing to blow up your own company, the market will blow it up for you. It was inevitable that they were going to go out of business. It was inevitable that a flex had to happen. The question, were they going to make the decision, or was the good decision going to be thrust upon them? We have seen this pattern over and over and over again, where companies become protective of their business models rather than advancing their just cause. Finite-minded leaders, finite-minded companies, fear surprises. They do not like uncertainty, which is why they look to exert control. And it's much easier to exert control over short time frames, which is why they play shorter and shorter games. Infinite mindset. We embrace opportunity in uncertainty. We love surprises. Because in an infinite mindset, we see all the possibilities in uncertainty rather than fear it. And this is what the Kodak people didn't understand. They put themselves out of business. And as I said, we've seen this over and over again, the protection of small business models at the expense of advancing a cause. Why is it that Apple invented iTunes and not the music industry? Why is it that Amazon invented itself and the e-reader? They invented the Kindle and not the publishing industry. It's because the publishing industry was too busy trying to sell books rather than find new ways to help people read. Why is it that Netflix invented itself and not the television and movie industry? It's because they were too busy protecting their old business models that they completely missed the opportunity. Do you remember Blockbuster? Blockbuster was the only legitimate national and international video rental chain. It was the only, the 800-pound gorilla. And when Netflix showed up, it was this rinky-dink little company, but it had a new business model called subscription. Do you remember we used to get DVDs in the post? You could keep them as long as you wanted. And we knew streaming was coming. The technology wasn't there quite yet, but we knew it was coming eventually. And the CEO of Blockbuster went to the board and said, we need to explore the subscription model. And the board would not allow him to explore subscriptions. Do you know why? Because they made 12% of their revenues from late fees. Blockbuster doesn't exist anymore. Literally gone. Because they were more preoccupied with protecting their short-term revenue stream than they were seeing what was the future and advancing something more noble than simply selling a product. It's existential because it is literally a matter of life and death for your company. Do you have a capacity for existential flexibility? And finally, number 5, the courage to lead. this shouldn't have to be on the list, but it is. Because every single thing I have explained to you is unbelievably difficult. It is so much easier to advance short-term goals. It's exciting, we can bonus people, we can have the thrill of the game, than it is to advance a just cause. But the infinite game is not simply a series of finite games. That gets exhausting. I see this with a lot of senior leaders, believe it or not, that they've been doing the same rat race over and over again, and it becomes thankless, and they feel like this is pointless. And they've made a ton of money, and they've accumulated a lot of authority, and yet, for some reason, the joy of work has completely disappeared because they're not asked to advance anything anymore. Advancing a just cause is difficult. Building trusting teams is really hard. It's like being a parent. It means we have to show up to work every day more invested in the lives of our people than in ourselves. That's hard work. It's thankless work. It's lonely work. Not everybody's cut out for it. It's 24 hours, 7 days a week. That's what leadership is. And yet that is the job of good leadership. It's so much easier to just hire and fire people at will. And if they don't make their numbers, fire them. If they do make the numbers, promote them. Good leadership is hard. Worthy rivalry? The thrill of competition, way more fun than having to take a look at ourselves and say, I suck. I'm no good. I need to work on myself. I better fix this. It's way more easier to just try and beat somebody else. Way easier. Existential flexibility, who cares? Literally, I won't be around when the company collapses. Kodak, every single one of those executives who suppressed that digital technology, every single one of them had retired by the time Kodak declared bankruptcy. They made massive bonuses on all the revenues they were making from those patent royalties. Is that responsible business? You can run your business however you want. You have to have the courage to lead, which begs the question, where does courage come from? I don't believe that courage is some deep internal fortitude. I believe courage is external. It's like jumping out of an airplane. You don't have the courage to jump out of the airplane. What gives you the courage to jump out of the airplane is the parachute on your back. A world-famous trapeze artist would never try a brand new death-defying act for the first time without a net. It's the net that gives them the courage to try something new. And if you've ever met anybody in the military, they don't run towards the sound of the gun for God and country. It just doesn't happen. It's the person to the left of them and the person to the right of them. It is a deeply human experience. I've met people who literally risked their lives. They did not believe they would survive in order to save the lives of others. And I asked them, you have a family, you have children. No one would have ordered you to do what you did. No one would have faulted you if you didn't do what you did. Why did you do it? They all say the same thing, because they would have done it for me. The courage came from the belief that someone has our backs. And that same courage, those same relationships are required if you want to play in the infinite game. We have to look after the people around us. We have to nurse our relationships. Because when times are tough, when we doubt ourselves, when things go wrong, when we're forced to take a step back, when we are beaten down, we need someone in our lives who says, I believe in you. I've got your back. If this whole thing goes south, don't worry, I'll still be here. You got this. You got to do this. That's the courage to lead. Are we helping others maintain the courage to lead? All of this discussion about playing in the infinite game and building infinite-minded organizations, it makes us wonder, what does it mean to live an infinite life? Clearly, our lives are finite. We're born, we die, but life is infinite. We come, we go, life continues with us or without us. We don't get to choose if we want to be players in this game. Once you're born, you're playing. And we don't get to choose the rules of the game. Life is an infinite game. The only choice we get is how we want to play the game. We can choose to live our lives with a finite mindset, which means we want to be more famous than everybody else, richer than everybody else, accumulate more power and more rank than everybody we've ever worked with. And when we die, we take none of it with us. How many of us want on our tombstones the last balance on our bank accounts? Or what your last title was on your business card? Of course not. We want on our tombstones the kind of people we were. The kind of people we were to others. Loving mother, devoted father. It's our service to others that we want to be remembered by. And this is what it means to live our lives with an infinite mindset. It means we show up every day to see that those around us rise. And one day, we will ask somebody who's achieved great things, how did you become who you are today? And they will say your name. The influence that we have in the lives of others, the lessons that we've learned that we can then pass on, the inspiration we can provide, the love that we can give, literally gives us the power to live on beyond our own years. We can literally live on forever in the lives of others. It's just a choice. Thank you very much.
Wow, Simon Sinek live on stage during Purpose-Driven Leadership.
Yes, he's a great storyteller, isn't he? In selecting the pieces to show to the audience listening now, we only thought we could do the entire talk because it's so profound and it's so well thought through. So we decided to put in the entire talk in this podcast.
And of course, a big thanks to Simon for allowing us to do that.
Yes, he's very open about that. He wants to spread his ideas. So anything that helps spread the ideas is welcome. So this podcast, of course, as well.
Yeah. Okay, well, I really enjoyed the Purpose Driven Leadership Seminar, especially with Simon Sinek. So it was great to have him in the podcast and in Amsterdam.
Yes, it was a unique opportunity.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to Think Tank and have a nice day.
Goodbye. Bye.